Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I are joined by Tanner Yarrow. Tanner is a Numinous client who agreed to come on the show to share his personal experience of how ketamine-assisted therapy helped him overcome crippling anxiety, face existential fears, and ultimately reclaim his life. Tanner shares his perspective on combating the stigma around psychedelic therapy specifically and psychotherapy generally. We also explore how he navigates being a nonconformist in the culture of his religious faith and how playing Dungeons and Dragons can be good therapy. If any of you listening to this are looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous's training programs. You can click the link in the show notes or go to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. I teach some of those courses, and it's been a pleasure to see some podcast fans in the audience. So please don't hesitate to sign up if you'd like that training. If you'd like to support the show, you can always do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can subscribe on whatever podcast player you're listening to, or if you're watching us on YouTube, subscribe to the YouTube channel, like the video, and share it with somebody you think might enjoy. Without further ado, here is our conversation with Tanner Yarrow. Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. For those of you watching on YouTube, we are in an alternative location.
Alternate reality?
Alternate dimension location. We're honored to be joined today by Tanner Yarrow. Tanner, you want to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, I'm Tanner Yarrow, a ketamine, I wanted to say survivor. That was the first thing that came to my mind, but I did ketamine, changed my life. I have a fascination with psychedelic medicine. And I run a Dungeons and Dragons accessory company.
Can't wait to get into that. That's awesome. Yeah, we thought Reed and I have wanted to have more client perspectives, like people whose lives have been affected by, improved by their decision to do psychedelic assisted therapy, in your case, ketamine. So we just thought it was a cool opportunity to have you on here, talk a bit about your history, your past, your experience with the medicine, and possibly Dungeons and Dragons. We'll go with the flow.
Yeah, I did ketamine at your clinic, and I'm not paid to be on this podcast. This isn't an ad.
Right. We don't have the budget for that.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to, I love selling as well, and I don't want anybody to leave here and try it and be like, Tanner convinced me and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But so there's that disclaimer. Now I'll dive in. I'll totally sell it because it was an incredible experience.
This is not medical advice. It's Tanner's story.
Right. I am not a doctor.
Yeah, for educational purposes only. So, yeah, give us some context. Whatever you want to share about your history, your past.
Mental health journey.
Yeah, and what eventually led you to your decision to do ketamine treatment.
Yeah, so a little bit of my background. I am the oldest of four. I am exactly Elizabeth Smart's age. And I think that was kind of what started this
same day
journey for me. No, not exactly, I guess. I don't know when she was born. We were actually in Hawaii the day that she got married, though. And so she was there.
And for those who don't know, most people probably know in the U.S. who she is, I would imagine.
So but Elizabeth Smart, I want to say when she was like 6, 7, 8. I'm totally pulling this out of my butt, but I was her same age. She was kidnapped from her home.
In Salt Lake City.
In Salt Lake, Utah. And it was all over the news. And it was kind of probably talked about pretty casually around me as a child. But totally launched this like OCD fear of being kidnapped my whole life.
You must have had some kind of latent or brewing anxiety that latched on to that as a fear as a kid, right? A fear of being kidnapped as you're laying there in bed.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird place to start this story, but just to get some context, when I was I'm married, and throughout my first 3 years of marriage, I would lock our own bedroom door and would wake up every night, every couple of minutes to check if it was still locked. Mm-hmm. So obviously that was like a part of that anxiety. I used to go around the house with my dad, make him go with me and check every single window and door for years. I mean, I slept on my parents' floor until high school.
Was there some separation anxiety for you as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I slept on my parents' floor, right? Yeah. So I would I would always try to go to bed in my bedroom, and then I would wake up in the middle of the night with panic attacks and go with my blanket and my pillow and sleep on their floor. And so, I don't know. I don't want to, like, label anything as, like, trauma. But as I've thought about coming on this podcast and telling my ketamine journey, I think there's pieces I've been able to pick apart of, like, where my OCD behaviors came from, where my fears came from, where my anxiety came from. And so, yeah, so building off of that, me and my wife got married 4 or 5 years ago. And amazing. She's absolutely incredible. And when we had our first child, we didn't want to do the kind of the traditional, like, she stays home and I go work and she raises the child. So we agreed 50-50 right off the bat.
Cool.
So when the baby was born, I think I compartmentalized it really well, but this is like when all of these past things, like, I started to realize that they were issues and they were, like, never dealt with. Yeah. And then they exploded.
We hear that a fair amount, or see that when people bring a child into the world, it's like a lot of those, deep-seated fears, some underneath the surface, come out. Like, you have this, like, precious, vulnerable child to take care of. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's also part of just, like, growing up, because I was totally that idiot, rebellious kid that, you know, I would water balloon cars. I would throw yogurt at cars. We would run from police officers for fun. I would drive way too fast in my neighborhoods growing up. And now I'm like, I've had friends die from getting water balloons thrown at their cars, cliff jumping, cave dive, things that I did for fun. And then you couple that with, like, having a kid, and now I'm, like, yelling at teenagers driving through the neighborhood, going way too fast. And so
tables have turned.
The tables have turned.
Yeah.
But when my son was born, the 50-50 thing went as far as, like, my wife didn't breastfeed. She wasn't producing enough milk, and so we almost right from the very beginning were bottle feeding him. And so we took that 50-50. And we were both waking up every couple of hours to feed him. And
hey,
this,
good for you.
It was this fear of work. Like, so when he was born, she was in labor for 5 or 6 hours, not as bad as, you know, some of these stories that you hear. But there was this moment where he was stuck in the canal and the doctor was like, I have to suction cup his head to pull him out.
This gets the plunger
yeah,
out.
Yeah, he's like, this can kill him. What do I do?
All those disclaimers.
And I'm like, what do you do? What? I'm not a doctor. What? Yeah. You tell me what we're going to do. And he's like, I just need your permission. This is what I recommend. And so he suction cupped this, like, handheld, pressurized it, ripped him out. This baby came out crying. My son had, like, this ball, like a tennis ball size, like, big thing on the back of this sack filled with bruised fluid for like, and I, you know, babies are just so fragile.
Birth trauma.
But then that coupled with, like, not sleeping. And then I started to get this weird OCD of, like, I could not sleep. I would wake up every hour and need to check on him. Is he still breathing? Are all of our doors locked? I mean, I was I was getting out my gun that I have under my bed in my safe and clearing my house, like, once a week, because I would hear a noise probably in my dream just to make sure that nobody was going to come in and kidnap him. Totally irrational in hindsight, but it got to a point where the lack of sleep mixed with the anxiety of being a new dad, I became just so depressed.
Wow.
Not even functioning, like, you know, my hobbies, video games, just like, you take out the checklist. I think the only thing I didn't have was suicide thoughts. because my fear of like, what is my wife and kid going to do? Yeah, maybe it didn't even have a second, but everything else, like my hobbies, not interesting, wanted to sleep all day, couldn't work. And I was trying to run a business at the same time.
Yeah. That's one of the, I think the most awful parts of depression, there are many, but that what we call anhedonia, like lack of pleasure in things you used to enjoy, or essentially making the world black and white instead of color, or sucking the joy out of it, is like, just by definition, that is awful to experience.
Yeah. It was hard. I mean, the it's funny to say, and I got to get over these like insecurities, but I think I had postpartum. I didn't even have the baby.
Mm. Yeah.
But so in this, like the lowest I've ever felt, I started secretly going to a psychiatrist.
Secretly.
Even my own family were like, Yaros don't need therapy. Like, what are you doing?
The
like
stigma.
You're fine. You have the gospel. You have church. You have all these things that should suffice. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there trying to rationalize it. Like, you know, if you believe in God, like he's probably up there being like, you guys go to therapy. Like I created these doctors and the science to help you. I mean, that's how I rationalized it. I'm still very religious, but.
And did you open up to them eventually?
Yeah. And that's kind of a funny story as well. But when I was meeting with my psychiatrist, we were trying all these traditional medicines.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of messing me up more. Mm. I would maybe get an hour of good work in, but I was like, groggy. And then we switched to this other one and it made me wet the bed. And I'm like sitting with my therapist being like, am I a psychopath? Like that's one of the traits of a psychopath. And the psychiatrist, like bless her soul, was just like, you know, maybe you have bipolar disorder. Let's try these meds. So I tried them and then we went back. I'm like, this didn't work. She's like, maybe you have GAD. And I remember sitting across from her. I'm like, what is going on? Like, we can't just keep, she's like, it's a guessing game. And that's when I spoke with you and I literally said, I feel like I'm not myself. I just need a reset. And that's when you were like, psychedelic medicine can give you a reset. And ketamine is legal. It's a legal psychedelic reset. And so I went into that with like obvious anxiety of like, I held off for a while because I was like, you know, you hear those horror stories, people that go under anesthesia and just die.
Mm.
I was like, if it's going to happen to anybody, it's going to happen to me.
Yeah.
But it got to a point where my depression was so bad. I was like, bring it on. Like, if I die, I need to fix this.
Mm.
And the psychiatrist was so awesome. He was like, it's not going to kill you. Ketamine is one of the safest anesthesias. We give it to children when they get their teeth pulled.
Mm-hmm.
And so that eased my soul, and then I did ketamine. So we're at that part of the story.
Cool. Thanks for sharing all that.
Yeah. So cliffhanger, I want to move right on. So tell us about your ketamine experience.
So I didn't really research it. I was maybe 50-50, found something that distracted from my depression in just being a Mormon boy in Utah. A legal way to have a psychedelic trip was kind of cool and interesting.
Uh-huh.
So there was 50% of me that was like, that's kind of exciting and interesting and new. And then the other 50%, maybe the other 80% was, we got to fix this. And I think this will work. And so we booked a session. I did one session. It was injected into my arm. I brought some music. They gave me a blindfold,
eye shades.
And I remember being fine until, so I was laying in the chair. I had the eye shades. I had the music going. The doctor was like, I'm going to sit here the whole time. You're going to disappear for like 30 minutes. I'll be here when you get out. Don't stress. And I remember sitting in the chair, they injected it into my arm. And I remember kind of fighting it at first. And then I remember this overwhelming panic of like, what did I just do?
Mm.
As I started to drift,
Yeah, that can be scary as the world is changing. Like, this is a non-ordinary state of consciousness, an altered state. And, like, especially if that's a new thing to enter an altered state, there are a lot of parts of us that can freak out for a moment or longer and fight it. Or
I mean, at this point in my life, I had maybe puffed a marijuana cigarette one time and, like, never touched anything. And I don't want to compare ketamine to drugs, but like you said, it was this altered state of consciousness that I had never experienced.
Yeah.
So as I was drifting, I was trying to focus on these pinpricks of light under my mask. And they just started elongating. And what's so funny, disclaimer, before ketamine, I was probably the type that would like make fun of hippies and their like terminology of like grounding and like out of body experience and like ego death. But after doing ketamine, I am like, that is the only way to describe these things, these experiences. Yeah. So I'm drifting, the pinpricks become like three-dimensional. And I remember thinking, okay, I just can't lose where I am. I'm in a chair at a doctor's office. And I remember that thought like pulling out of me. And I remember thinking, okay, I can't stop thinking. If I stop thinking, I will die. And then I remember even losing that and being like, I can't stop thinking, but I can't remember why.
Layers are getting peeled away here and it's uncomfortable, huh?
Then there was this moment of, I am dying. And I didn't know where I was, but I knew that I felt like I had made a mistake. And then the worst fear bad trip. I would say it was in hindsight. We'll change this terminology because in hindsight, it was exactly what I needed.
A difficult experience.
But it was a difficult experience. And I remember in that moment of like, I'm dying, just finally coming to the conclusion in this experience that it was okay. It just was happening. I couldn't stop it. And in that moment, you know, there's one of those hippie words I like, what's it called? Like not elevated, but like
transcended.
Ascended.
Yeah. Transcended.
I felt like I ascended and I heard the voice. I think it was of God. It was maybe my internal monologue, but it just said, what are you so afraid of? And that's, I said, cool. this. And this voice said, well, focus on this. Is this bad? And I remember thinking, no, this feels great. I feel good.
It's good. Good advice and questions from your higher self or whatever that voice was. That's really neat. So you touched into this sense of peace after going through those doorways of fears, it sounds like.
It was this pure sense of peace. I had let go of this fear of death, accepted it. And then I remember in that moment, I started seeing my wife's face and my baby's face and they were giggling. And that's it was cool. Like so funny to me that I came out of it. I all of a sudden was in the chair and I was laughing. And I'm like lifting up my blindfold. I'm like, where am I? And I'm like trying, I'm like coming out of it. And the psychiatrist is like, sit down. And he was like laughing because I was laughing. And he's like, tell me everything. I'm going to write it down because you won't remember. Maybe that helped me remember, but I vividly remember everything. I went home. I felt a little nauseous for like 12 hours. Went to bed. And I kid you not, I woke up completely fine. I went to work. I did everything I needed to do. I cleaned my office. And from that moment on, literally that day, I have had it's not fair to say none of those feelings because everybody will have bad days, but it's maybe once a month I'll have a lack of a desire and motivation, but I will play some video games.
It wasn't the predominant like cloud of depression over everything.
This cloudiness, the depression in one treatment for me was gone.
It lifted, huh?
Now, that's not to say that it couldn't come back. It's not to say that it wasn't, you know, some permanent depression that I was dealing with, or if it was situational. But for me, I felt like I needed a reset.
Yeah.
I was instantly my old self with kind of this new insight on death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where these hippie words start to come back, where it's like, I think I had like an ego death.
Mm-hmm.
This other version of me that was terrified of death got to experience it. This is going to scare mm-hmm. people. Like, I'm looking at myself in the camera. Like, if you're thinking of ketamine, I had a friend that I convinced to do it after I did it when his fiance broke up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like floating on clouds and had an incredible experience. Now, I said bad trip. You said difficult experience. In hindsight, it was the most valuable experience that I could have had. I don't lock my bedroom door just from that moment.
Yeah. It's fascinating that all these fears and behaviors in response to those fears do seem to have a common thread of like fear of death. If you kind of follow those deeply, like you were doing what you needed to do to try and protect your family, your loved ones, yourself from like uncertainty and harm. And those showed up at a transition point in life, when you had a baby, not sleeping as much, vulnerable. And then you face that in this experience, it sounds like. Like you had this lived experience of feeling like you were dying or losing parts of yourself or losing control. You had to eventually in that experience surrender. Yeah.
I mean, it's been 2 years. And I will still hear that voice from my experience when I wake up to a bump in the night and I'm immediately like somebody's in my house. I will hear that voice that just says, what are you afraid of? Who is trying to kill you? Who is like, has you on their hit list? Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And I can roll over and go back to sleep.
Tanner, I want to highlight that in particular because, you know, we should say individual results may vary, right? Not everyone's going to have a Tanner Yarrow experience. But it didn't take those thoughts away from you. It sounds like what it did is it gave you a connection to maybe God or the higher power, however you think about it, that can help you self-soothe when those thoughts show up. And I just think it's important because a lot of people will approach ketamine or psychedelic medicine and hope that what treatment looks like, what a good treatment result is that they are spared from their pain completely, or they're spared from the thoughts that cause their psychological suffering. And you describe something that, like you said, some people might call a quote unquote bad trip. Reed reframes it as a challenging experience. I think one of the things that's really valuable about ketamine and psychedelics is if you go in there with the intent, for example, help me understand my fear or show me how to be at peace. A lot of the path to that insight has to be through. And because you were willing to feel it and actually go through it instead of resist and run away, it was only on the other side of that surrender that you have this now very durable experience. So it's one of the reasons why we often reframe quote unquote bad trips to challenging experiences. Admittedly, there can just be some really bizarre, very uncomfortable psychedelic experiences that don't obviously have a lot of meaning to them when at first brush, but
bad trips may in fact exist. We've talked about that.
Yeah.
Well, I just immediately am reminded of a metaphor, and I'll just tell a short story. We work out together. You've come to my gym.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this like everybody is invited, right? Mm-hmm. It's this awesome group of, you know, we bring whoever, we have a sauna. It's this awesome experience. One time I invited this kid who didn't ever work out and didn't probably have a lot of friends. And I was like, you should come lift with us. And he came and we were lifting and I was helping him. And he does one rep and he stops and he sets the weight down and he looks at me and he goes, what's the point? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, it hurts. Mm. And so my metaphor for this, you could describe every hard workout that you do as a bad trip. It hurts. It's painful.
Yeah.
But it's like when you reframe it, that's the goal, right? The goal is to tear those muscles. And I feel like the coolest part about psychedelic medicine, I think it's totally fair to call ketamine a psych. I feel like I had a psychedelic experience.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. I would agree.
and the cool part about psychedelic medicine is it involves the brain so much. Like it would be funny to me if when you have a cold and you took NyQuil, if part of the healing process of NyQuil was a psychedelic experience where this voice is like, we're going to push through this mucus together. But it doesn't happen. Most medicine just like works, and your body just takes the medicine and it works without you ever like, you don't have to mentally focus on, okay, I'm going to push the NyQuil to my membranes in my nose and clear that out, and we're going to work through this nasal trauma together. But psychedelic medicine it combines them both, right? I really do believe that there are physical remedies to ketamine. I mean, that's how they found out that it works, right? People were coming out of like root canals and they were like, I'm not sad anymore. So without even thinking that it was going to have some psychological effects, it was working. But to couple that with, you know, your brain and your spirit, mm-hmm. helping you work through things that are wounds that aren't inflamed sinuses, right? I feel like your soul and your spirit, I'm really, really going hard on this metaphor.
But yeah.
Your soul and your spirit are inflamed. You got to work through it a little bit different.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love it. 'Cause it is a tricky thing to work on the brain from this place we're at with a body and a brain, and the brain feels like it's in the driver's seat all the time, right? And I like how you're comparing it to the sinus analogy, because I mean, in the end, I think the brain, the mind and the body are inseparable. The spirit's a little bit hard to pin down, all these theories of consciousness and everything, but we know, you know, we're talking about something that's there, right? This transpersonal realm, the spiritual. But you're right. It does bring in all of those. It's like not just a physical experience and a mental kind of vivid, an emotional one, a spiritual one.
Well, yeah. And Tanner, also what you're describing is an active versus a passive approach to your mental health treatment.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about your experience with the antidepressants, maybe going there with that, like, doc, give me the medicine that's going to treat my illness. And so you were getting into that guessing game territory, like maybe this drug will work, maybe this drug will work. But there wasn't as much sort of participation on your end. It was more of a passive approach. And it's one of the things Reed and I talk about with that's a bit different than the psychedelic assisted therapy approach, is that, you know, you are an active participant in your own healing. You set your intentions, you're prepared with navigation instructions. And the medicine experience has everything to do with what you bring to it, at least as much as what it brings to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, it reminds me of what we talked about earlier, how these hippie words start to really have meaning. I hope I don't offend anybody with that. I fully embrace that lifestyle at
now
this
point. You're one of them, us.
You're a hippie,
whatever.
Hippie convert. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you hear, you know, the mind, you know, the Buddhist monks, the mind is powerful. The mind can heal you of anything. And I feel like most laymen like myself are like, okay, how? I sit there and I'm like, okay, don't be sad anymore. It doesn't work. So you have to bring in some medicine that can kind of explore those worlds. And I'm at the point now where, like, if somebody is dealing with depression and they come to me, which is so few and far between, I'll almost push them towards psychedelics and ketamine first. And I think of like my computer. If my computer's having an issue, the first thing I try is turning it on and off again. And to me, that's ketamine. It's like, look, I knew you before. I know what you're like. You know what you're like. I would recommend, let's just try a reset.
Yeah.
Now, then if that doesn't work, then let's get into balancing the chemicals in your brain, knowing that that is like a journey in and of itself. And we're going to play a guessing game and try all these different medications. To me, ketamine, and I'm not a doctor, but ketamine, shrooms, like these psychedelics that heal on like a mental level, that should be like the first step. Am I off base here? I would almost go there first before I take something that was manufactured in India. Oh, that's actually where ketamine comes from. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like these little white pills that
Yeah.
Are probably overprescribed.
I totally get what you mean. And the more we work with these things and understand the use and the safety, the more we start to think about them earlier in the treatment algorithm, like where ketamine used to be reserved in early studies. Like my first ketamine study ever, this is 2010, was for treatment-resistant depression, where you had to have failed tried and not benefited from at least two antidepressants, for example. But it was really interesting to hear your experience with the traditional meds and the side effects, and then your experience. I love how you described your ketamine experience, because they are different tools for different purposes. And like, there was this, there've been a number of studies over the past few years looking at like, how are these approaches different? Like Prozac versus psilocybin, for example. Because they both work on serotonin systems, among other things. But one analogy for it is like taking Prozac or an SSRI is like putting your emotional system in a cast for a time. And sometimes that's needed. Like sometimes you need to blunt things, but there are some consequences of side effects or emotional blunting. But like the classic psychedelic mechanism, and a lot of this applies to ketamine too, is more of like emotional connection and engagement. And that can be, like you described, uncomfortable at times, but it's almost, I like this physical therapy analogy too, where, you know, if you put your arm in a cast for a time, it should be temporary. Things get limited or atrophied, but you still have to do work. Like we come into this world dealt with a certain genetic deck of cards. We have our life experiences that lead us to having these patterns and issues of like anxiety, fears, depressive episodes. And what tools are used and helpful is an individual thing, but yeah, I mean, we're totally with you on, isn't it amazing to have options that are a non-daily pill that can help you move through it, even if that's hard, and get to the other side without needing, like your experience, needing to take the medicine again and again and again.
Yeah, I don't want to dog those medicines. I take methylphenidate for my ADHD. And that has been an absolute blessing in my life. It changed my life.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I had it until I was 30. And the focus I'm able to get and work through is amazing. So I'm not trying to dog those, but I think what you said of like introducing psychedelic therapy earlier, from my perspective, seems like the way to go. Because the other alternative is messing with your brain chemistry, right? And trying to find this balance versus, you know, for me, it was one trip in a chair that lasted 30 minutes with 12 hours of nausea. That was better than the week of whatever they had me on that had me wetting the bed and, you know, having a really gnarly brain fog and, you know, really messing with my sexual drive and my brain chemistry. And now, again, I don't want to dog those things because I really do believe that at the end of the day, it's all brain chemistry, right?
Yeah.
I can say that I heard the voice of God, but what's probably happening is my brain is balancing chemicals and sending signals and talking to myself, you know, like you said, consciousness, we don't really know, but
maybe God works through serotonin.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we choose to be humble about what's actually going on. There's certain things we can measure. Like we do know in some ways what ketamine does to the brain, the things that change in the brain as a result of taking ketamine. But yeah, I try to avoid making declarative statements about the nature of consciousness and the universe. So we just stick to what we're experiencing, stick to what we're observing. So what you experienced was real. Real in the sense that you experienced it.
Real unity, real, like a mystical experience. And
You could be like, that's not God, he doesn't exist, or she doesn't exist, or whatever. But it's like, hey, I heard the voice, and to me it was a powerful entity, and it totally saved me. And I can think of a few powerful entities throughout culture and history that saved people. I don't know, that's kind of throwing in my
that's beautiful
little pitch for.
Well, and we often talk about the importance of integration, of how to integrate a psychedelic experience into one's life so that you don't necessarily have to keep returning to the medicine, so that those changes can be durable. And that's kind of what I'm hearing, Tanner, is that one of the ways that you integrated your experience is that this voice, so that this voice could continue to comfort you, is you sort of imbue it with power that allows you to trust it. So when you wake up in the middle of the night because you hear a noise, instead of doing what you used to do, you have this memory, you have this connection to something that you can trust, something that helps you feel safe. Because a lot of people who maintain fear maintain it because they don't feel like that there's anything or anybody that they can trust, right? It's hard to feel safe when you can't trust yourself, trust the people in your life, or trust God or the universe. And here you have a lived experience of connection and comfort and peace and trust. So call the voice whatever you want.
Yeah, building off of that, totally it went into my utility belt of tools, both ketamine as a medicine and the experience that I had. You know, as two separate tools, I got ketamine in my back pocket if I ever experience more situational depression or trauma. That's probably where I'll go first. But then locking that experience in. Now, I want to back up a little bit, because you reminded me that, you know, the ketamine worked right away, but it took me, you know, a week or two of, okay, I'm not going to lock the door tonight. And I would lay in bed and I would panic,
but
I would fight through it. And I had a restless night and I woke up the next morning and I was like, okay, I'm okay.
That's cool.
So there was like some internal working that I had to do before I got to the point where now, like, I went downstairs this morning and my back door was unlocked. And like that would have never happened 2 or 3 years ago. I would have never had the mental strength to even attempt to go to bed with my bedroom door unlocked.
Yeah.
So to your point, it wasn't ketamine, like I did ketamine and I'm laying in bed and I'm like, hey, none of my doors are locked. I'm totally good. But it was like, okay, I'm going to start trying this. I'm going to start working through some of these other things. And then going to regular therapy has been awesome.
Cool.
And there was even a moment where I was trying to convince some family members to go. And I was met with one of my family members said, well, you just think everybody should go to therapy. Why don't you go to therapy? And I was like, I do go. I thought I said that, but I love it.
That's
I've
cool.
been going and I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much of this I love and want to highlight, like what you said about integration being real work. Like that's where the rubber meets the road, right? You have to make changes in real life where they're needed. And maybe like the idea is with these medicines, you make things, you get a perspective on it, you see the forest from the trees, and you have more malleability to shape patterns, like thanks to the neuroplasticity, the openness, the perspective. And you took that mystical experience, the God's voice, and made it sacred, or you said locked it away. Like I love that. We do that with clients or groups sometimes, have them build a fortress or a castle somewhere around their experience and go back and use it, revisit it, tap into that. And there are a lot of ways to do that, and then therapy, of course, represents doing the work to make it stick. So
yeah, and I mean all that aside, you know, I am a very spiritual person and I feel like I have regular communion with my God or my version of God. I'm trying to be as
ecumenical as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I feel like if you were to ask me in a church or spiritual sense, I would say that yes, I can ask my God questions and feel like he answers me, that they answer me.
Yeah.
But this experience was so different to where I often find myself, you know, asking God in prayer the same questions over and over again and looking for that reassurance, but not taking this of like, should I be afraid of death? Like that experience and that ketamine experience that I had was so powerful and went so far beyond, you know, me saying my morning prayer and attempting to open that pathway. And so it's, you know, for me, it's very spiritual, but for me, it was also unique in the power of it. And I really do believe, going back to those hippie words, that I had that ego death where it stripped away those layers, created a spot in my brain for it. Yeah. And then gave me the willpower to work through it. And so, yeah, that's why I'm like, if somebody's like, man, I feel like I'm not myself. I feel like I'm always like, have you tried ketamine?
I love that you're bringing the spirituality, and I'm a big fan of the power of one's own spirituality to, in a mental health journey, big time in life in general. And you know, I have this theory that, because people throughout time across the globe have used psychedelic medicines to commune with the divine, right? Like, that's part of psychedelic history, and you can see why, but I have this theory that, like, part of that ego death is getting ourselves out of the way of that channel with whatever spirituality is. We're staying out of the weeds and the debate of like specifics, but these experiences like you had, that's real and powerful and goes a long way. So I'm glad that's coming up, because like even from the research, when you combine having a mystical experience with facing something difficult, like we measure these, like the emotional breakthrough inventory or the challenging experience thing with a mystical experience, that's when you get some lasting change. Like you're getting into that place and flexing that muscle and having this important experience that you remember and use. Yeah,
I think it reminds me in the gym. Again, I'm going back to the gym a lot. It's a big part of my day, part of my life. People on YouTube will be able to know that I'm telling the truth. But, you know, it is this place where I'm a very devout member of my faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I work out with, you know, a Muslim, an atheist, a Buddhist. Like, we have a really ragtag crew that spans the gamut of spirituality. And so it's always fun for me to try to look through every single one of my experiences through a more open lens.
Mm-hmm.
It's honestly, the honest truth is, it's solidified me in my faith even more so that I'm able to explain some of these beliefs that I have on a level where it doesn't, you know, people always want to explain their religion through the lens of their religion. But you get people that aren't of your religion who aren't going to have any of your same beliefs. And so you have to be able to explain them through their lens. So what I'm getting at is, if I were to, you know, meet somebody that was interested in ketamine and they said, I don't believe in God, and they were very strong in that sense, you know, that might turn them away from this mystical experience. But what I would say is, you know, you have a consciousness, and your brain alone is more powerful than you think. And ketamine can help you tap into that, right? It goes beyond, like, for me, it was this God figure that came in and gave me that power. But I also believe that my brain is that strong.
Yeah, it works.
I just didn't know how to use it.
Yeah. Works through your own belief system and your systems for living. It reminds me of the, have you heard of the Marsh Chapel experiment? In the Ram Dass, Tim Leary days, when Ram Dass was Dick Alpert, and they were both working at Harvard, there was this experiment, a study done, where they gave psilocybin to divinity students at Harvard in the basement of the Marsh Chapel in Boston. And they gave some placebo, some psilocybin, a good dose. And then this famous pastor gave a sermon. There was a choir who sang. And so the set and setting is pretty cool already. But what was interesting about it is those who got psilocybin were more likely to actually finish their divinity program and become the pastors that they wanted to be, like, it deepened their faith. And I think that's, like, the more common thing that we see is people having, like, openness to an experience within their, like, spirituality, or an expansion of their spirituality.
Yeah. So maybe you'd even take it as far as, like, not, I mean, I do believe that anybody is powerful enough and that it can help them get to that point. But it's also kind of funny to be like, well, you kind of have nothing to lose. You know, is God real? Well, he's in that clinic and they can give you the shot and you can go, you can go meet him or her, whatever they are, and see, you know. I think that it was such a cool experience. And I mean, I'm even to the point where even if you're not dealing with something, there's power to be had by aligning your mystical spiritual self, your consciousness. It was that, right? I believe that one thing that I believe in hindsight with the ketamine experience was it stripped my body from my consciousness. And right before I died, mm-hmm. in my experience, that was all I had. I felt like I was pure consciousness.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I'm going back to that thing. I would probably, 20-year-old me would make fun of somebody that said, you know, in my head, never to their face or to behind their back, but in my head would be like, you're ridiculous. But then you have this experience and you're like, it stripped me down to pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And then that consciousness was able to, you know, let me know that it was there. Let me know that it is a part of this body experience and that it can help balance these chemicals. I'm trying to just look at it through the most agnostic view, but that's how I feel.
Yeah. There's this topic of the overlap between spirituality and mental health or mm-hmm. spirituality and psychedelic experience is a really interesting one. Didn't Roland Griffiths do kind of an updated experiment on the Mars Trap and found very similar things. And there's a book I'm about halfway through by, I think, Don Latton called God on Psychedelics. And he interviews all these, you know, religious people like pastors, priests, rabbis from all these different faiths about their psychedelic experiences. And they're tracking with what you're talking about, Tanner. So also you mentioned, you know, that maybe psychedelic tools could be useful for people who don't have a diagnosable mental illness. And we've talked quite a bit about that on this show, that psychedelics are powerful tools that can be used for a variety of purposes. We talk about psychedelic assisted therapy because that's what we study and that's what we do. But
yeah.
I mean, modern Christendom would probably hate this idea, but we talk about this a lot in the gym. But if I was, you know, one of the children of Israel, throw me right into the Bible. Moses comes back from Sinai or the cave or whatever. I'm not that good at remembering these things, but he comes back and he's like, I spoke with God.
The burning bush.
He was a burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
I would be like, what did you take?
Sounds pretty trippy. Yeah.
There are some theories that like the acacia tree or whatever, it contains DMT and maybe he had a little bit of ayahuasca or something up in the hill. But who knows? I believe that people can have those experiences with and without medicines, right? And medicines can be catalysts for it. Like we know that from the modern studies is take enough of a certain psychedelic, you can occasion a mystical experience in most people. And that doesn't, like, some people take an issue with that because it's being occasioned, but I don't see a problem with that. Like, it's a tool, and
that's what
it's working through us.
Yeah, you got to see it as a tool. Like, I honestly believe that my father, if I told him that I believe Moses took something when he saw the burning bush, he would say that was blasphemous. But for me, I fully believe that Moses spoke to a burning bush. It doesn't bother me if he took ayahuasca beforehand or not.
Yeah.
It literally would not shake my faith because everything in Christendom is my lens is through physical things. When you're baptized, you are immersed in water. If God didn't need tools, physical tools like a pool of water to do that experience.
Yeah, those are tools too.
Those are tools. Yeah. We take a sacrament, right? Catholics take wine and bread. They physically eat something. And if they don't, then that thing that they did doesn't work.
Mm.
I did that. I'm sorry. But so why is it so hard to believe that, like, you know, God put a plant on the earth that helps you commune with him. They believe that he put a book on the earth that helps commune with him. Why can't, I mean, that came from a tree. We're getting really weird.
Maybe, I like that parable. Maybe Moses found a great meditation prayer hack And if so, good for him, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, and with tool. You, I've done breathing exercises without yeah. any medicines. I've done meditations where I've had out-of-body yeah. experiences. So you're totally right. But even those to me are tools, right?
Yep.
In breathing exercises, you are filling your blood with CO2. And that is yeah. just, you know, you're breathing in the medicine, and what the medicine is it's a deprivation of oxygen. And I'm totally speaking out my butt here, but
theory,
this is what
yeah.
I, yeah.
Theory number two is Moses went up there and did a bunch of holotropic breath work or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, or hit his head in the yeah. cave and had a dream or something.
And that happens too. Yeah.
Yeah, well, fasting is a tool, song is a tool, chanting is a tool. I mean, you could really call any of these things we do to alter perspective tools. So I think you're on point, just to be a little bit more like less judgmental about all these things, more open-minded about all these things.
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, my perspective is, you know, psychedelics can be totally scary for people who are religious mm-hmm. because it's not prescribed. Actually, you probably grew up your entire life, if you were a member of a church, thinking that it came from the devil. Right?
Yeah.
Devil's flower is literally the nickname for...
The devil's lettuce.
The devil's lettuce. But, yeah. you know, I truly don't think that's fair. And if you really do believe in a devil, I think one of the best things he's going to do is convince you that these tools and medicines should be avoided at all costs. Mm. Right? If there's a tool that helps you connect with your spirituality to that level... If the devil is real, he doesn't want you near that. And so he's playing 4D chess. I don't know. We're probably going down lanes that are no, losing people, but
it's a fun rabbit hole though. Yeah.
Speaking of rabbit holes, before we hit record, we were talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and you had an interesting thought about Dungeons and Dragons group therapy. Can you tell us? I wanted to bring it on the show because I was curious about.
Yeah. We were also talking about Rorschach tests. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's just another level of a Rorschach test, right? So you show somebody, as far as I understand a Rorschach test, you show them an ink blot picture, right? And you say, what do you see in this? And it kind of unlocks layers of their brain, you know? It's, oh, I see some dad beating his son. And you're like, oh, that probably happened. I'm totally, like, I'm not a
therapist or a doctor. It's not quite like that, but yeah, you're getting
that. am I getting you're in, the
you're
gist?
In the ballpark,
or like
yeah.
we were talking about earlier, sand tray therapy, where you take figurines and express your world. Like, these are symbols used to communicate or represent, like, your inner world or your life that are really useful in therapy. And when you combine that, like, with... a group, D&D is such a creative thing, and you can be whoever you want to be, and you could see how that would be such a cool experiential group therapy modality.
Well, yeah, I imagine if I was a therapist, if I could get one thing from my patients and they would tell me honestly, it would be like, what is the ideal version of yourself? You know, mm-hmm. where do you wish you were? Things that probably take years of therapy to unlock. But with D&D, you can totally like sneak it in. Cause it's like, yeah. let's make up a character, full fantasy character that you get to play as. And D&D dives into everything from their race, their magical abilities, their background, their parents, their siblings,
their personality.
The book
yeah.
specifically is like, come up with 3 points of, doesn't use the exact word trauma, but like, crazy experiences that the dungeon master can use. So it's like, my sister was killed by orcs. Mm-hmm. And that to me is like, a therapist could use that as a tool to be like, you know, especially somebody that doesn't want to open up in that way.
Yeah.
To be like, look, let's create the ideal version of yourself. Let's go through and pick their race, their height, their gender, their everything. And then let's go on an adventure and mm-hmm. deal with literal trauma and see how you navigate that. And then the way that Dungeons and Dragons build, it's one of the greatest games outside of fantasy football mm-hmm. because you can quite literally do anything. And it just has created yeah. this sandbox. And so I know of some universities that are using it. I know BYU here in Utah is, they just launched a group therapy program that just uses Dungeons and Dragons.
That's cool.
So it probably takes some time for therapists to study kind of, you know, if they pick this character, if they want to just be a paladin that saves people, what does that mean?
But it's content. Like, that's what we look for in therapy, is stuff that comes up in the here and now, and your here and now is going to spill out in that kind of role play adventure interactive experience. Like, I think it will.
Yeah. I think the really cool part too is, like, kids are getting into Dungeons and Dragons younger and younger, and like, what a cool tool to be able to help a kid to open up, you know?
Yeah.
It's, I was telling you before we record, one of my sons is way into Dungeons and Dragons, and it's absolutely done that for him. He's really creative. He's a great writer. He's a great sort of character developer, got a great imagination. And so I've learned a lot about him just by having him tell me about his D&D campaigns, mm-hmm. tell me about his character. He's also hilarious. His characters are named funny things and they have weird backstories. And
that's cool.
One of his first characters was, he was a buffin, which is a buff muffin. He just made all this up, that had interdimensional powers. And like, he would call upon the buffin to come in and like,
that's why D&D's
shoot muffins
best.
Out of a muffin cannon and stuff. It was great. I loved it.
People always look at D&D from the outside and they're like, this is the dumbest nerd game ever. But if they just sit down and play one time, they'll realize that everybody is just giggling at the stupid crap that they come up with. Mm-hmm. And that's D&D. You go into a tavern, you leave 5 minutes later with the whole thing burned to the ground, solving nothing.
So you work in this world. What are you working on in your D&D accessory company right now? What are you providing to the community?
Yeah, Dungeons and Dragons doesn't require much. It's an imagination, a paper, and some pencils, and it hasn't really changed in 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few ways to express yourself in D&D, and those are the dice that you bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And dice are used to simulate randomness, kind of the physics of the world. If I throw a rock, does it hit the thing that I throw it at? And so when you just have a piece of paper and a pencil and some dice, you know, one thing that we make is cool dice that allow mm-hmm. people to show up at the table and feel cool and you know, express themselves in that mm-hmm. way. And maybe that's another therapy tool. We should do a study where we have lots of different kinds of dice. It's kind of like a Rorschach test. It's be like, this is your character. You know, which dice? Ooh, you picked those. That's, I know where we need to go now.
Right.
But
That's cool. That's really cool.
What else are you working on?
We are doing a folding board game table, kind of branching out to bigger and bigger audiences.
Currently on Kickstarter. Doing well, I hear. Yeah, that's awesome. Congrats.
Yeah, it's fun. I have a good team, and a lot of the stress comes from them. Just kidding. But
they're supposed to help with your stress.
No, it's been awesome.
Where can people find you or your cool
YaroStudios.com.
Cool.
Or I'm all over TikTok.
Mm. That's Y-A-R-R-O?
Y-A-R-R-O.
YaroStudios.
No W. And then my core audience is probably Dungeons and Dragons specific, because we're just now starting to kind of go beyond that.
Cool. That's exciting.
But yeah, it's fun. I think everybody just wants to be happy. And so trying to make ways for people to do that, trying to create, you know, tools that release dopamine is kind of what I do from a very non-scientific side of, like, how can I just bring a little bit of happiness to people and make money doing it? I think I'd be lying if I said that wasn't like one of the goals as well. But if you can make something that
delights your customer, like Steve Jobs said.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for sharing your story. That was really touching. And I think and hope will be really useful for people to hear.
Yeah, a lot of what you said, I think is going to be really relatable. And I think we made all the appropriate caveats about everyone's experience mm-hmm. being different and all that stuff. But yeah, Tanner, I really appreciate you being willing to tell us your story.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
No, appreciate you guys. It's fun. And then I'm having my second baby, November 16th.
Congrats.
So we will see. I have all my tools ready. Yep.
There
to
you go.
Cool. So we will see how we navigate now that I get a second shot at doing it all again. It's gonna be a real time experiment. Mm-hmm. We should do another podcast the week that my baby is born, and then a couple months after. If they find this interesting at all. So
yeah, we'll have to hear an update.
Yeah, well, we're rooting for you. Awesome. Yeah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Tanner.
Cool. See you guys.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.